The Falling Middle Cast is a spin-off series from the creators of Mars on Life. This series provides review and commentary of Barbara Ehrenreich's Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class. Since this series analyzes the text and provides a critique on class in America, this is not a comprehensive audiobook and follows all copyright claims. Now, back to the show. Been a while. No, it hasn't. This is the Falling Middle Cast. I'm, of course, one of your co-hosts, Ryan Mancini. Joined with me, as always, is Sebastian Shug. Sebastian, how's the weather over there?
Gloomy. Yeah, it's raining. It's relatively poor to a degree, but I guess that ultimately depends on whether or not you can stomach being outside in the first place when it's blisteringly hot. I personally like it. I understand that it's at least 10 times as bad where you are. So,
yeah, at least one part, and listeners, you're hearing this in the future. So, you're hearing this in the future. So this information is null and void. Although you could always go back and check with the weather service, for the records, but I think like at least one part of Worcester got over 8 inches of snow today. It's projected to get, I think, around 12 inches. So a foot, but I don't know. I went outside and actually wasn't too bad. It was kind of slushy, which was weird. Just sloshing around. I felt like I was on Dagobah.
Not Hoth, the obvious answer.
I know. It was like Hoth like a good hour before, and boy oh boy, I was like, should I go out to get photos and for work? And I still did, but it had died down by that point. My glasses were soaked, and my face, I looked like a friggin' cherub when I got back, but, you know, I was warm, I was bundled up and ready to go, but...
Well, I mean, if we were a weather podcast, if all we did was storm chase, if all we did was take bets on what the next day would bring, you know, I'm sure it would be a nice discussion. However, we're not here to talk about what falls from the sky. We're here to talk about poor people. No, we're not. We're here to talk about what makes people poor. There we go. Okay, you could
see,
you
with
put
the
down
fall,
the, you could put down the pitchforks
already there. You could just keep going with that, but you're just like, you're like, screw subtlety. I'm just
we steamroll on the Falling Middle Cast. You know, I mean, granted, it's taken Barbara Ehrenreich, let's see here, and this is not to spoil the book, 375 pages to tell you what I told you in a sentence. Oh, well, that includes the index, too. Okay. Well, without further ado, we're going to look and see what makes these children. We're going to look and see what makes middle-class child-raising ambivalence and anxiety. We're going to make sure that we see what makes it tick. And I would go on and on, but I did the last chapter, if memory serves me right.
Mm-hmm.
So, floor's yours.
Well, okay. Middle-class child-raising, ambivalence and anxiety. Viewed as a strategy for class advancement, professionalism contains one nearly fatal flaw. The emerging middle class had erected steep barriers around its professional domain for the purpose of excluding intruders from other classes. But, like it or not, the same barriers not only stand in the way of outsiders, upstarts from the lower classes, and the occasional amateur from the upper class, they also stand in the way of the children of the middle class. Just had to, like, hone in on that just because I feel like that's anyway, I'm not going to try and get on a tangent right at the get-go. For most children born of the middle class, the barriers are not insurmountable. Unlike those who are poorer, middle-class youths are likely to have the money for tuition and the leisure for an extended education. Thus, barriers that the middle class erected to protect itself make it painfully difficult to reproduce itself. It is one thing to have children, and another thing, as Midge Dector realized in the early 70s, to have children who will be disciplined enough to devote the first 20 or 30 years of their lives to scaling the educational obstacles to a middle-class career.
I don't like this. I don't like this already.
Nor is there any obvious, reliable way the older generation can help. All that parents can do is attempt, through careful molding and psychological pressure, to predispose each child to retrace the same long road they themselves once took. Sounds familiar. Hence the perennial middle-class preoccupation with the problems of child-raising. In The Lonely Crowd, David Reisman wrote of the contagious, highly diffuse anxiety middle-class adults bring to the business of parenting. Nor, in the middle class, is child-raising a matter that can be entrusted to parents alone. For in their uneasiness as to how to bring up children, Reisman noted, parents turn increasingly to books, magazines, government pamphlets, and radio programs. Though the day-to-day work of child-raising is left largely to women, isolated in their homes, child-raising in this class is also something of a collective endeavor. The province of scores of experts, psychologists, commentators, counselors, each feeding off of parental anxieties, offering new solutions, raising new alarms. Middle-class parents face a particular dilemma. On the one hand, they must encourage their children to be innovative and to express themselves, for these traits are usually valued in the professions. But the child will never gain entry to a profession in the first place without developing a quite different set of traits centered on self-discipline and control. The challenge of middle-class child raising, almost the entire point of it, in fact, is to inculcate what the reader will recognize as the deferred gratification pattern. So when the spokespersons for the backlash blame the student rebellion on permissiveness, they were not, as it seemed to students at the time, changing the subject from politics to a trivial domestic issue. Since in this class, child raising is of grave professional concern to many people beyond the parents, the blame of permissiveness fell not only on the actual mothers, but also on the spiritual fathers of the class, the experts and professionals. Permissiveness pointed to some fundamental weakness in the entire class, some breakdown of rationality, will, or as Bettelheim termed it, inner resistance. Is the middle class overly permissive towards children? The late 60s anxiety about permissiveness reflected a real change in middle-class child-raising practices, but one which was certainly overdue, apparently short-lived, in its extreme form, and at any rate, highly ambiguous in its consequences. For most of the first half of this century, permissive child-raising was unknown, or at least strongly disapproved of, within middle-class homes. It was almost a sociological truism that the lower classes were permissive. The middle class was rigid and disciplined. As late as 1957, a sociology textbook reported, for example, that the middle class is subjected earlier and more consistently to the influences which make a child an orderly, conscientious, responsible, and tame person. Some academic observers even hinted that the middle class went too far in its demands on its children. The result is the producing of persons who are controlled, sometimes to the point of lack of spontaneity, regulated, diligent, and able to forego the pleasures of today for the rewards of tomorrow. The middle class's emphasis on discipline and deferred gratification goes back to its emergence as a class near the turn of the century. One of the many areas of endeavor that middle class professionals meant to rationalize and reform was child raising, and what they meant to reform was what they saw as the old habits of indulgence and coddling. In the new scientific age that seemed to be dawning, children would have to grow up to be disciplined and efficient. Therefore, they would have to be raised in a disciplined and efficient manner. Times for feeding and sleeping had to be rigidly scheduled. Impulses squelched. Bad habits, thumb-sucking, crying, masturbation, swiftly punished. In fact, in turn of the century child-raising advice, pleasure of any kind was subversive to the production of useful adults. Production being in quotes.
Right.
Wow, the snow kicked up. Eating a thing because it tastes good or drinking a thing because it tastes good is doing a thing that gratifies the sensual. Mothers, if you begin that way, what are you going to do 15 years later when the primordial urge gets into that young person's blood and he looks out at the world and turns to the right and to the left for other forms of sense gratification? One of America's
I love how you read that in like a 1960s stilted news reporter voice, because that's literally what embodies mass hysteria. Can you believe it, folks? Oh, my God.
I went through kind of a roller coaster, because I was like, there's the radio voice, but there's also the preacher. There's also, oh, my God.
Eating a thing because it tastes good or drinking a thing. Like,
there's the guy from Network. I'm blanking on his name. I can't believe it. But yeah.
Like, you could just say any televangelist. You know, you could hold out your hand and be like, mothers.
Well, that was why I was
if
doing.
If you begin that way.
Raising my hand up like, hallelujah. Yeah. One of America's first generation of professional psychologists, John B. Watson, laid out in the late teens and 20s that what became the middle-class child-raising dogma for decades. Babies were to be picked up only at scheduled feeding times. Other than that, they were to cry until they learned the wisdom of self-control. Children were to be seen, but only briefly, and then for the purpose of useful correction. The ideal child, he wrote, is one who never cries unless actually stuck by a pin, illustratively speaking. Who puts on such habits of politeness and neatness and cleanliness that adults are willing to be around him at least part of the day? Who eats what is set before him, who sleeps and rests when put to bed for sleep and rest, who finally enters manhood so bulwarked with stable work and emotional habits that no adversity can quite overwhelm him.
I feel as though I've already been dealt a crappy hand when hearing this, because it makes me think that all my years spent being a kid, being a young boy, set me up for failure. Because if I was put on this earth for the sake of correction, I mean, hell, I would probably perform top of my class, top of my work. I wouldn't have any emotion to go off of. I probably wouldn't even consider the difference between right or wrong. I probably wouldn't be as empathetic, but apparently that's the cornerstone way to do it. Like, shoot, I guess my parents failed me.
To achieve this ideal, parents were to guard against any reckless display of emotion on their part. Never hug and kiss your children, Watson warned. Never let them sit on your lap. If you must, kiss them once on the forehead when they say goodnight. Shake hands with them in the morning. As Martha Wolfenstein, a colleague of Margaret Mead, observed in her study of government child-raising pamphlets issued between 1914 and 1960, babies were originally portrayed as having strong and dangerous impulses.
No, like they couldn't conjure up the ability to say, hey, I'm hungry, or hey, I took a shit. You mean the impulse of crying because they didn't know what to do and haven't developed their frontal lobe? Oh, darling, they can't speak or walk for that matter, or use the restroom properly. What?
Like, Stewie Griffin would have thrived in this world because he just would have walked around and just been like, you know, oh, yes, hello, mother. Instead, like, these people got actual babies that acted like babies. And
they didn't know what to do with it, as if they didn't, like, understand the undertaking of, like, hey, having unprotected sex is going to yield a child that really can't do anything but just eat and poop and cry and is going to be solely dependent up until they're of a post-ambulatory, like when they can walk and when they can function to a degree. But then when they hit their head on the wall and then they start crying, like, they're still kids and they still don't know any better. So it makes me wonder, like, what they expected. And at that point, it's not like 2023. It's not like people opt to having pets over having kids. It was the other way around. You know, you got a dog for your kid, Johnny, because, you know, either, oh, well, we're not having a little brother, or the friends are too far down the street. So, yeah, let's get little Timmy a dog.
Yeah. You know?
But nowadays, it's like you have pets, and then you think to have kids afterwards if you can afford it.
And in this case, like, it really was for the idea of like, oh, we're gonna be fruitful and multiply. And it begs the question too of just what it was. You know, if you've got young parents, you know, say it's 1917. Okay, bad year. Because 1914 okay, to 1960, it's like there's a lot of bad years in between those two.
We just go full doomer, and let's say it's 1927, and you're on the cusp of what you think is going to be the next best decade of your life, and you end up under the cuff of a family dynamic that, oh, why is dad not at work? And why am I suddenly hungry all the time? And why is, well, like, where's the food? And why is our house getting foreclosed? And like, and I'm thinking of the worst possible scenario as an example of the Great Depression, because like, what do you do with this mindset of raising children, essentially complaining that, shocker, get this, children act like children and babies to that same respect, and then find yourself in one of the most disastrous economic times ever? Like, what then? What does that do to your child raising capabilities? And what, and really, what does that do to you as a child? Like, how do you grow from that, from those experiences of what your children, of what your parents are teaching you?
Well, and then think of the flip side of, and of course, this is what gave us the baby boom. You know, think of the flip side to that, where it is economic prosperity,
mm-hmm.
You know, oh, war is over, everyone's coming back home. And it's this idea that we're just going to become this big baby making machine, because, you know, oh, we can do so, we can do that. But then to boot, like, what does that also mean for our economy? What does that mean for us on the world stage? Like, mm-hmm. You know, the fact that you have now more discussions in the world about like child raising and genetics and eugenics and like all these creepy little things that erupted from that, not even just post-war, but pre, you know, the war era. So it's, but it makes me wonder, like, if you're a parent in, here's a safe year, 1915, you know, it's 1915 America, you're expecting all these things from your kid, from your infant, but if you've got any grasp on, like, what babies are like, say, you know, I don't know, say you're old enough to remember your baby brother or your cousin or, I don't know, your neighbor's baby, what have you, pre-1900, I mean, there's none of this, well, yeah, we're going to go out onto the farm and we're going to shake hands with a baby boy. Like, no, it's like it was all normal and people were human to each other. But this is like taking it just to such a level. But it's no different from like today, where you have those kind of weird generational ticks and changes that 15 years ago would have seemed bloody weird.
I mean, I would say that we've changed as a species in regards to the child-parent relationship, though I can't, anecdotally anyway. I mean, there are certain family members where it's just not of me and of them in the relationship that we've established to say, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly express it through like a hug or, you know, even a handshake. And I think what it is the fact that, as someone growing up in a different era, you can either choose to respect that or you don't, you know. And by, I guess, not respecting that and for going over certain boundaries, and I mainly find this associative with men, maybe men and their fathers, or perhaps grandchildren and their grandfathers. It's weird. I've seen it be a little bit of a barrier to cross, and I don't know. I've also seen the flip side of that, where perhaps the parent isn't as, you know, emotional or keen on establishing like a father-son relationship, but is more emotionally keen and is more, you know, lovable and open and opened up when that son has children. So now there's a grandchild in the equation. So, you know, maybe it just takes a new generation to kind of realize the importance of that. But, you know, there are times where certain family members, it's like, hey, I'm going to shake your hand. Maybe I'll give you like one of those like pats on the back hug. And that's about it. And really, I think that ultimately comes down to whether or not you feel that that's comfortable. I mean, if you're visiting a family member and you instantly go in for a full frontal on the lips kiss, then I think there might be some further discussion warranted about that. But in my umpteenth time of me saying, read the room, and I swear to God, I'm going to be saying that in the psych ward one day over and over. You'll see that written on the walls. That's the only real solution I have, is to just understand who it is you're talking to and have an established relationship towards.
Well, anyway, let's keep on going. It is hard to believe from the vantage point of the 1980s, such were the times, that anyone ever followed these draconian instructions to the letter.
We weren't even bored back then, bro. Okay.
But one widely cited study published in 1948 found that middle-class parents were at least trying. They placed their children under a stricter regimen, the study concluded, with more frustration of impulses than do lower-class parents. Middle-class mothers were more likely to feed their babies only at scheduled times, less likely to breastfeed, and were inclined to begin weaning and toilet training months earlier than were lower-class mothers. In fact, one reason for the decline of household servants among the early 20th century middle class was that lower-class women could not only be trusted with middle-class children, they would spoil them with hugs and sweets and contaminate them with an easygoing outlook fatal to middle-class achievement. But sometime in the 40s, there was a sudden shift in the experts' advice. Middle-class parents were encouraged to make a more relaxed approach, to trust their instincts, and to respect, at least in a limited way, their child's demands. Whether this shift signaled a radical breakdown of parental authority and middle-class self-discipline is, of course, a matter of judgment. In retrospect, it looks more like the inevitable correction of an approach that had bordered on cruelty and neglect. The new permissiveness, as reflected, for example, in the 1940s edition of the government's infant care pamphlet, reads today like common sense. Where the baby's impulses had formerly been described as fierce, they now subsided into almost complete harmlessness. Masturbation had previously been described as a threat to health and character, which parents were instructed to prevent by tying the baby's hands and feet down to the mattress at night. There's a different sexual question thrown into the mix when you talk about that. Now it was portrayed as innocent exploration. Play ceased to be...
Wait. Now it was portrayed as innocent exploration. You can and package that wholesale now. Like, you want to talk about sexual exploration? Okay, there was a joke in there, but you see more people doing that now, tying... You know what? I'm going to stop there. You get the joke. I'm sure that takes on a deeper meaning, a new meaning now in 2023.
Play ceased to be a dangerous form of overstimulation and became the natural and, in fact, required interaction of mother and child. Play and singing, advised the 1942 edition of Infant Care, make both mother and baby enjoy the routine of life. Almost as soon as the advice changed, so too, apparently, did the actual behavior of middle-class parents. In fact, the change was so swift and unexpected that it precipitated... Just had to make sure I read that right, because I say precipitation a lot for my job. A period of deep confusion among sociologists and psychologists. Which class was doing what, and which class was right? According to surveys of parents, the middle class had precipitously abandoned its Watsonian regime and embraced the permissiveness that had formerly been observed only among the poor and the working class. Good, good. In fact, some studies suggested that by the mid-50s, the middle class had actually surpassed the permissiveness of the lower classes. Toilet training their children late, at a year or older, feeding them on demand, and treating them more or less as reasonable little people with legitimate desires. You know, like Danny DeVito. The shift in child raising practices reflected a profound change in the
See,
conditions
Ryan thinks he's so profound when he makes
of
jokes
middle
like that.
class life.
I'm laughing, don't worry.
Oh, maybe I should
But
have.
you can't see me laughing.
Maybe I should have been like, feeding them on demand and
Like
treating them more or less as reasonable little people with
you
legitimate
audience
desires,
members aren't
like Danny DeVito.
audience members aren't seeing the flaring nostrils and the breathing out the nose.
The switch to what was later pejoratively described as permissiveness coincided, give or take a few years, with the onset of post-war affluence. Ah, okay, so now I have jumped the shark, kind of, or jumped the gun, rather. Mothers who might otherwise have worked outside the home were devoting themselves full-time to child raising, and, no doubt, expecting a role more satisfying than that of drill sergeant. Furthermore, middle-class homes increasingly gained the space and appliances to cope with messy behavior and prolonged incontinence. It may have been the automatic washing machine, as much as anything, that allowed middle-class parents to overcome their traditional obsession with cleanliness and postpone toilet training into the second year. There was also, as sociologist David Potter recognized, a subtle psychological relaxation that came with material abundance. We may think of permissive child raising as a result of our enlightened ideas, or as a result of developments in the special field of child psychology, he wrote. But the fact is that the authoritarian discipline of the child was but an aspect of the authoritarian social system which was linked with the economy of scarcity. At a time when businessmen were trying to figure out how to make hedonism more seem moral and thrift seem misguided, it made little sense for child raising to be an exercise in mutual deprivation. In the more permissive child raising literature of the post-war period, the baby was even conceived of as a tiny consumer. Its impulses were valid, its wants legitimate. If it wanted to wake up at 4 in the morning, eat nothing but strained apricots, or eschew the potty seat until the age of 3, it must, in its infant wisdom, know what it was doing. The good mother did not need worry. Indeed, as Dr. Spock advised, she trusted her own maternal impulses to mesh neatly with the baby's infant ones. The ultimate test and measure of the parent-child relationship was pleasure. As infant care told mothers in the early 40s, the baby will enjoy the new experience better, in this case, solid foods, if you are having a good time. This was the permissive idea, ideal, rather. Mother and baby enjoying each other, consuming each other, moving from one tiny gratification, a smile, a meal, a bath, to the next. But this was only the ideal, and it was the ideal only briefly. Full-blown permissiveness, even as an ideal, lasted for less than a decade. By the early 50s, most experts were renouncing over-permissiveness and stressing the importance of setting limits appropriate to the realities of the environmental situation, meaning presumably that toddlers should not pee on the living room carpet. In the 1951 edition of the government's Infant Care, parents were even warned against infant megalomania. Oh boy. The baby, whose needs had been harmless only a few years earlier, could now get the parents at his mercy by unreasonable demands for attention. And the indulgent mother may find her baby getting more and more demanding. Return the device, woman!
PragerU has many videos about this very topic. I think one of them's even called like The Power of No.
Yeah.
And it's basically a 3-minute video as to, at first, I think the average college student who sort of stumbles upon a Turning Point USA booth would probably, get his first dose of conservatism put on him. Would probably look at that video and think to themselves, well, I'm not going to have kids, so what does this apply to me? But as they go through it, they look more and more at the fact that, like, yeah, it's good to like delay that gratification. It's good to say no because then it sets expectations. And then you get into the whole argument of like when you're actually a parent and you kind of have to take politics out of the equation for the most part because you have a literal human being at your feet, then you sort of have to look at it differently and look at it case by case. And that's what I don't understand is the fact that, like, yes, there is power in no, but do these individuals not realize that it's ultimately circumstantial? I mean, if my 16-year-old, and I don't have a 16-year-old, but if my 16-year-old is asking for the newest make and model of a car that's going to run me, I don't know, four total school payments, I'm going to say no. And I'm going to say no on the basis that it's not a practical or fiscally responsible approach. But if it's like, hey, mom, I want a ball out of that little key lock machine, or the quarter machine,
Yeah.
provided that they're not of the age where they can easily choke on it, and or that they would like throw it in the store and break shit, which, tell you the truth, as a parent, I'd secretly like want to see happen because I too am interested in physics. Okay, you kind of have to gauge that. You know what I mean? Like you kind of have to. And I hate to say barter with your kids because I have personal experience with that. Like if you behave yourself, I'll get you a toy kind of thing. So it's
Yeah,
just
I went
crawling
through
back
that,
to me, and I really don't know what answer to take other than just like no is not always the right answer, but it is a good answer. I see where this is coming from, though. Let's just say, like, don't give in, but don't give up, kind of thing.
ultimately it is a balancing act, and I'm not gonna try and show off any understanding of parent of being a parent, just because I'm not, and I'm not at that point where I want to think about it. As a kid, yeah, it was a balancing act. I mean, it was no different than how it could be if you behaved versus misbehaved with your teacher. Your interactions with your parents when you're really, really little are more than likely going to give you some sense of what it's going to be like when you're much, much older, on what it's going to be like to actually like interact with other people in real life. So make it count, infants. In fact, in its extreme form, permissiveness may be far more intrusive and manipulative than mere command. I think of middle-class parents I have known and observed who are, in my judgment, truly over-permissive, but they are by no means simply lax and yielding in the way that permissive parents of the lower classes were supposed to be. The middle class permissive relationship became a ceaseless, intense dialogue. Do you want this or that? Now or later? Or maybe something else? A dialogue extending in some cases right down to which morsels of food on a plate will be eaten and in what order. No statement is ever final. You can't have that now. Everything can be renegotiated. Well, maybe you can have it if you're good.
All right,
If
that's
the
another point.
Yeah. If this is permissiveness, then the secret of it is that permission must be won, or at least fought over, minute by minute. And the kind of personality that results is not likely to be easygoing, but profoundly insecure and desperate to please.
Yes, because you don't want to be a bad parent who continuously tells their children no. But then again, if you don't tell your children no, they're going to turn out nothing of what you hoped for. And
Yeah.
they'll never have a sense of discipline. And that's one thing that I personally do want to thank my own parents for doing so. They understood what a healthy balance was, because you could safely argue that one parent was one way, one was the other. And it worked because I think it was, they were so separate in their ideologies that it was easy to understand the difference between both and
Yeah.
understand the goods and the bads associated with each. And, as a teenager, of course, it's easy to look at your parent who constantly says no, even if it is not even constant, but occasionally, and look at them as a tyrant because you didn't get to go to Coachella or whatever, Oh, fuck my dad. You didn't let me go out. I'm like, you know what? Knowing Coachella for what it is now, you'll come to thank him.
You rationalize it to yourself, especially when you are a kid. I feel like I can safely say this when it comes to my own parents. Like, they kind of fluctuated with how they played that game, where, you did have the parent that would always say no, but then when it got to the point where the parent who always says yes started saying no more and more, to the point where it became an in-joke in my family, as a kid, you're going to think to yourself, wow, this, like, negotiating thing is really hard when, like,
I
you
also
think you're
feel
doing
like,
everything right, and then all of a sudden, every answer is no, and you're like, well, tell me what the right answer is, because clearly I don't get it, you know.
I also feel like the capitulation of that often escalates to the point of go ask your mom, go ask your dad, when they just don't want to deal with it. So I can't blame them, especially if, say, you happen to have siblings or other individuals in the house where it's like you can't keep up with the demands of your child. But really, it's just your child thinking everything is interesting because it's the first time that they're seeing everything.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
the child of authoritarian parents can at least withdraw into fantasies of freedom or revenge. But the child of overly permissive parents has little inner space.
Can we say that we jumped the gun on that?
I don't know, because like
revenge is not the Jedi way.
Because like freedom or revenge, like if I'm looking at my, you know, like for example, my dad, and personally he was never like this, but if I looked at my dad as like a tyrant, you know, wouldn't that be like, I'm gonna do everything in my power to make sure that his saying no is wrong, and I'm gonna internally justify that for myself, even though now that I'm a man in my 20s, I can safely say now I understand the reasoning for him saying no. You know, now I understand the reasoning why he told me to wear a helmet at baseball practice because it hurts when you get hit with a ball. And I didn't think it looked cool, but, you know, it took me getting hit in the head with a ball for me to be like, okay, I'll wear a helmet.
All of its whims have been noted and addressed, even if not always indulged. It has learned to expect from its parents not only security and affection, but the pleasure of instant response and approval. By the age of 3 or 4, it has, more likely than not, become addicted to approval, or at least to attention, and has no sure sense of itself. Hey, 100 pages. When the attention is momentarily withdrawn. As the social observer Philip Slater has observed, permissiveness is actually more totalitarian. The child no longer has a private sphere, but has his entire being involved with parental aspirations. Perhaps that was ultimately more disturbing about the student rebels, or what was ultimately most disturbing, was that they reflected their parents' aspirations only too well. Or as Sean Connery would say, only too well. The problem was that they were, by the 1950s and the 1960s, violently conflicting aspirations. On the one hand, there was the stern technocratic ambition, nurtured by the middle class since its origins in the progressive era, to achieve self-mastery, and in the process make the world conform to human reason, or at least to their own version of rationality. And this was represented in the young Jacobins of the left, who sometimes liked to fancy themselves professional revolutionaries, and whose imaginations were drawn to the Third World, in part, as a land of perpetual scarcity and hard-edged moral issues. Moral values. Oh, that's a different story. Unblurred by affluence. On the other hand, there was, in the parents' generation, the languid desire to surrender to affluence, to forget the world, and enjoy the moment, or at least the next purchase. And this less noble impulse was vividly parodied by the hippies, freaks, acid heads, and flower children of the counterculture. The fact that the hippie and the Jacobin were often the same person did not make the parallel between the generations any less compelling. Their grown-up critics, the defenders of discipline and professionalism, knew themselves to be no less compromised by the easy life. Permissiveness became a potent charge because it symbolized that fatal compromise with affluence and self-indulgence. Beginning in the 60s, permissiveness replaced affluence as the focus of middle-class anxiety and class consciousness introspection. In fact, as we shall see, the scope of concerns embraced by the notion of permissiveness quickly expanded beyond child raising to include every possible failing of the middle class. By the end of the 60s, even the limited generosity that had been inspired by the discovery of poverty would be vulnerable to the charge of permissiveness, as if the poor and the young had at last been fused into a single massive social problem.
Next time on the Falling Middle Cast, the revenge of... No, I'm kidding. I just wanted to read that like an announcer's voice. The revenge of the lower class. Something had gone wrong with the children who became the 60s rebels. But it was not permissiveness or much of anything that went on between parent, child, and Dr. Spock in the split-level privacy of the suburbs. What the backlash theorists forgot was that in the 50s, the home had become a receptacle to open to other influences that poured in through television, radio, phonographs, movies, and of course, the Falling Middle Cast. Most of the incoming images were bland enough, instructing the public as audience how the middle class lives. Mom behind the counter in a spotless motel-like setting, perky kids waving dad off to work, teenage romances leading to more of the same. But another signal was also coming through, an incitement to the young to think of themselves as a distinct social group with a rebellious agenda of its own. One consequence of affluence was that children, and particularly teenagers, had money to spend. They were consumers. Teens had only recently become a clearly demarcated age group. Demarcated?
Mm-hmm.
In the 40s, when the word teenager came into widespread usage, that is. In the 50s, they became something else, a market. According to historian J. Ronald Oakley, by the mid-50s, teenagers were buying 43% of all records, 44% of all cameras, 39% of all new radios, 9% of new cars. 9% of new cars? What was the age to drive back then?
By the mid-50s.
That's young. Okay. And 53, it's certainly not... I mean, nowadays it's like 15 and a half, you get your permit. Okay, semantics. And 53% of movie tickets. By 1959, the amount of money spent on teenagers by themselves, and I love this, and by their parents, had reached the staggering total of $10 billion a year. There's that silver spoon. And see, when a group becomes a market in the U.S. consumer economy, it inevitably gains a certain self-awareness. American teenagers were still divided by the nearly impassable gulfs of class and race, but marketing men did their best to encourage the development of a universal teen identity, defined by teen clothing styles. Formerly, one went directly from children's to adult clothes. But this time, teen-oriented entertainment, teen music, teen fads. The products heightened the sense of collective identity. The heightened sense of identity sold more products. So, for reasons that had little to do with either politics or child-raising practices, the generation that came of age in the 60s was the first such age cohort to think of itself as a distinct group. Not young adults or older children, but the young, which ironically, in dressing all the same, became more conformist. That's not in the book. That's just an off-colored observation. I mean, how many different ways can you do the proverbial jeans and t-shirt, right? In sort of like the modern era, you know? But if that was the break from the norm back then, how many real ways could you typically style that? If it meant that like a rebellious young identity was different from the norm of, you know, slacks and dresses, for instance.
Well, you know,
more denim in the household kind of thing.
Yeah. That was the beauty of the 70s in a really twisted way. a lot of the things that we find disgusting and kind of like lazy with how people dress. And you know, like, I'm not saying I'm one of those people that's like, you know, oh yeah, you got to wear a suit when you go on a plane. A lot of the things that we point and laugh at, like how tourists dressed, for example.
Right, right.
That kind of was fed by, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, and Reeboks, am I right?
Reeboks. This group consciousness was an essential foundation for the student radicalism and youthful counterculture that followed in the 60s. Not only in the United States, but to a lesser extent in the rest of the non-communist world. The issues, the war, civil rights, poverty, were decisive. Without them, there would be no movement. But without youth's new awareness of itself as something more than pre-adults, the movement would never have taken the form that it did. The generation that entered college in the 60s brought with it a prideful knowledge of its own, a culture impenetrable to most adults, including those who made up the professoriate. More than any preceding generation of 20th century students, this one was not prepared to submit without protest to the lengthy apprenticeship that lay between childhood and full membership in the middle class. The apprenticeship was too long, and the goal, it sometimes seemed, was hardly worth the effort. Worse still, from a grown-up perspective, the teen culture of the 50s and early 60s contained themes that were, let's say, hostile to business and tauntingly subversive of middle-class values. Recall that at the time of the emergence of the youth market, the adult-oriented consumer culture centered on products for home and family was becoming too dull and inspire even the ad men. Was becoming too dull to even inspire the ad men. New images, new products, new excitement were needed. Most of all, it was rock and roll that forged the new teen culture. Rock was a potent commodity itself. It was also the theme that linked other commodities, such as clothes, movies, cars, to create a common teen style. Rock gave Blackboard Jungle, the first movie with a rock soundtrack, its insurrectionary power. And it was rock music that swept white middle-class audiences, along with the greasers and the gang members, to their feet, stomping and shouting. It was the music of the movement, the beat of insurrection, just as folk songs were the music of the student left in the 1930s. But see, the difference was that folk songs were for singing along too. Rock was for, quote, fighting in the street, cutting loose, getting stoned, screaming with hysteria, merging with a thousand other young people in all night, three-chord communion. It was the sound to youthful ears of freedom and defiance, just as it was also, especially in the 50s and early 60s, the, quote, jungle beat in which adults could hear the coming downfall of civilization. But rock and roll was not the invention of the young. It was the invention of the poor. I heard a rock beat for the first time on the radio of an African-American cleaning lady working in a friend's house, and I remember being shocked that this apparent non-entity, this invisible woman, was privy to such a wonder. While people like her employers and myself had to make do with Patty Page, rock came up from what we would now call the African-American underclass. It was brought to white audiences by a truck driver from Mississippi. It went to England and bounced back on the creative energies of four working-class boys from Liverpool. If there was a, quote, culture of poverty, this was its sound. And it was saying something to middle-class youth that they had not heard before. The message was not, to say the least, about discipline, achievement, and careers. It wasn't even about love, although this is what the lyrics usually spoke of. Love is one of the only ways we have, in a secular commercial culture, of talking about transcendent experience. And rock said that transcendent experience was available, possible now, not just pleasure or comfort or pride of ownership, but ecstasy. Rock, and of course drugs, took ecstasy out of the private realms of mysticism and sexual obsession and put it back into the public sphere as a social good. The point, in fact, of human community. To say that rock and roll was antagonistic to middle-class values is, of course, to understate the case. If theories of the culture of poverty were the middle-class critique of the poor, rock was a critique of the middle class, bubbling up from America's invisible, quote, others. It mocked work, get a job, study, don't know much about, oh, it's fucking song titles. How did I not pick that up? God, I really need to get a job, study, don't know much about history and authority. Charlie Brown, you're a clown. It held out no professions, no career except that of the reckless love man, not even a certainty of adulthood, teen angel, its idea of time, rock around the clock, had nothing to do with the scheduled order of achievements. In serious moments, it told of a world in which hard work went unrewarded. I feel like that's now.
You have that, but then you think of the flip side where people that don't work very hard are rewarded. Case in
Okay,
point, the owner of Twitter.
do we have
Case in
songs
point,
about this?
presidents.
Do we have songs about this?
We
About
don't,
the
but they don't
flip side?
talk
Well, then who
about.
gives a shit? You know, it's like I feel like
Well.
if there was a ne if there was the next musical movement in America, it would take the opposite of what made rock so prevalent amongst a sea and an air of the proverbial working class businessmen. So if you were to have a, I don't even know if you'd call this alternative genre, if you want to stick it in the other category, I don't care. Write about some jack off who spent his whole life burning through his trust fund and him having no social, fiscal, or emotional consequence to that. I mean, hopefully by the end of the song, he's like in jail because like he never grew up. But I mean, I think I'm just hoping too much here. But
I can.
that would be interesting, you
I'm
know?
trying to think of which songs. Admittedly, the first song that came to mind when you said, "Oh, he ends up in jail by the end," did make me think of one Bob Dylan song, but it absolutely does not apply to what you're looking for.
Got it.
So,
I mean, that's a challenge. I really do want to see that. And perhaps they exist out there. New music's created every day. If there is a song that goes against the grain, opposite of rock, but is still counterculture and basically saying, "Hey, the bum got his just desserts," I want to hear it. Or not the bum.
Yeah,
Let's
I was gonna say
say,
that sounds
let's
very
say,
antithetical to the
there we
concept of
go.
rock.
Let's say the
Because let's not
how can
forget, Nowhere Man is the
yeah.
bum's anthem in rock, in my opinion.
Okay, then let's not say bum, let's say the undeserving, should we say. One person who has no reason to attain the success that he does, like just completely earn his way through life by no stretch of the imagination other than just, I don't know, I guess lucky breaks. Like, wow, he really rolled a D20. But
But then that gets you to Billy Joel's Uptown Girl, where it's about a downtown man, and it's like he kind of succeeded. But anyway, keep
okay.
going. I believe me, you could get me down a rabbit hole
Oh
that's
man,
gonna.
like I really want to see that. I really just want to see the antithesis of that. Let me see here. Just as love so often went unrequited, where the good died young and the proud trampled over the proud trampled on the humble. Over time, the lyrics grew more overtly political and topical. But for many of us, the student left in the summer of 1965, Bob Dylan's mocking elusive like a rolling stone already seemed to say all that needed to be said about middle class arrogance and the futility of the professional paths middle class. And the futility of the professional paths middle-class young people were programmed to follow. Excuse me.
How does it feel?
Rock and roll, whether sung by a middle-class youth like Dylan or a vulgar-looking greaser like Elvis, was the revenge of the lower class. And if there is an explanation for the student revolt that goes deeper than politics and public events, it was in the vibrant new consumer culture addressed to the young and fortified with the repressed defiance of the poor. This was the Pied Piper that led middle class youth off the path of professional achievement and seduced them into betraying the ideals of their own class. This was the true source of permissiveness, or at least of a true permissiveness unqualified by parental ambition and manipulation. And such is the ingenuity of capitalism. It had taken the anger and yearning of the poor and sold them to the restless youth of the middle class. But the backlash theorists would not blame the consumer economy and were still too liberal to blame the poor. In identifying the problem as their own permissiveness, they had foolishly blamed themselves. And in doing so, they laid the foundations for a far more vicious kind of conservatism. One which would attempt to discredit the professional middle class altogether. And with the middle class in turmoil, someone else would have to be found to represent its traditional values, hard work and self-denial, against the tide of anarchy and hedonism. By the end of the 60s, that someone would be found in an unlikely place, the all but forgotten working class.
Waves his finger in Bernie.
Oh man, it's been a while since I've seen the end of a chapter, Mark, but that is the end of chapter two. Damn
Sure, you don't
kids.
want to start chapter three, or do you want to have a clean slate going into the next episode?
Let's definitely slate it until next episode. I mean, I feel like this was a pretty good ending point, if you have no objections. But it's interesting to see the dichotomy of parents and children, and how we were taken on a roller coaster of, you know, from conception to capitalism, how the kids were sold to the man.
And I'm not saying I'm an expert on this, because I know I'm not, but I know, like, in Marxist thought, culture feeds into class consciousness, and to talk about rock and roll and its overlap with these young people, you know, becoming who they were, becoming themselves. And, you know, I say that about more so the young people that, well, less so about the young people that ultimately became the baby boomers that brought down the whole world. But I mean, the you know, more of the counterculture movement. It to some degree, it's a little reminiscent of Erin Reich's other book, where she really goes into much further depth about it, Dancing in the Streets, which, again, is basically about how revelry, fighting for your right to party, if you will, it's very much, it like as much as the Beastie Boys make it sound like a revolutionary act, her argument is that, you know, it's ingrained in our DNA to have, you know, a moment of collective ecstasy that can also be considered revolutionary, and then all these outside forces of conformity, whether it's, you know, the church, whether it's governments, you know, it's totalitarianism, whether it's colonialism, like, there's so much of that that just brings down the right, you could call the unalienable right, for us to just basically go out and party. Sound like I'm from Wayne's World. And yeah, it is evocative of what you get with a lot of the music in the 60s, because with rock and roll starting off as it did, everyone was very, you know, straight-laced, suited up. You know, you can think of Ritchie Valens, Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, and, you know, for the most part, everyone does look like almost like any other yahoo from the 50s. And then that really starts to change, obviously, in the 60s. Even the Beatles had their straight-laced look in the beginning, but to really lean into the fact that, like, all of this cultural movement is coming from a much more middle class and, you know, working class, you know, working class hero is something to be, as John Lennon would say. It's just going to show how much that can really change things, and also influence all those young people that said, I'm not going to be like mom and dad. Does that mean jeopardizing a future in college? Does that mean totally alienating your parents because you decide, I don't want to be like you? My life is not yours. This is mine. I'm not going to be a clone of yours. I'm not going to be your mini-me. Then it really calls into question, like, the severe importance of what was going on at that point in time, and what it ultimately meant to all those young people that said, you know what, I've had enough. I'm going to be whatever I want to be. And that's something that you just, again, not to be the broken record, you don't have that prior to the 50s, really, 50s and 60s. But, I mean, since then, it's very hard as well to conceptualize it today, because I think, and I can't plead to be an expert on this, but I almost get the impression that you have greater conformity now, almost on the level of, like, how it was in the 40s and 50s, because, and I know I've talked about this before on Mars on Life, where you've got kids and parents that are on such equal footing with each other, and the way that they talk to each other, that it begs the question of, is this Is this because the kids grew up too soon? Because the parents kind of coerced them into that? Because the parents are so freewheeling? Or is it, is it just a consequence of a much more, for the most part, liberal age? All those things that even during the counterculture era that were so frowned upon became dominant. I mean, let's face it, how many old people out there that back in the day probably would have said, drugs will kill you, are not only hooked to something, but maybe they're hooked on to marijuana, for any particular reason. That liberalization of things has definitely pushed us in the direction of what all those young people wanted. The problem is that none of it actually produced any kind of substantial change that lifted everybody up. You still have the rampant racism. You still have, the rampant sexism. Unfortunately, the great music and the great culture is gone, and you don't have that sense of rebellion, and so it has to be sought out elsewhere, even if it looks manufactured. Hashtag resistance. Okay, chapter 3, The Discovery of the Working Class. Oh boy. So she's gonna knuckle down on the whole bit earlier about, like, oh, there's poor people? What? There's people that aren't overly affluent? What? I don't know. I mean, when you keep going with this book, what, there's a lot of times
It's
where you definitely jump the gun, but and I know, and I
right.
know you say that, so that's why I say it, but I guess, are you finding yourself more surprised by what Aaron Wright
No,
says, or are you
no,
just
no.
finding
I'm
yourself?
finding myself more so reassessed and reassured that these observations were made 40 years ago. And humanity just doesn't change overnight. I'm not asking it to or expecting it to, but right now, as I say that, I kind of am. I'm kind of already double backing on that because I feel as though, while attitudes can certainly define a generation to any stretch of the imagination, it's very easy to see what negative attributes filter into the next generation and how the generation that's supposed to take over the world and inherit the earth and have all this opportunity is now left with not a full deck to do so in many cases. And whether it still be prevalent important issues that, much to the chagrin of others who probably think, oh, nothing's wrong, we do still have issue of certain social and economic instabilities, political instabilities. We still have a class system which ultimately probably has to be financially assessed more. And it just makes me wonder why. Like, what needs to be done to fix it? I guess is my question. When will there be equitable harmony in America? Kind of a overreaching question, a question I don't think anyone has the answer to. You can't pick a date on the calendar and say, "Yep, that's it. America will finally be fixed and all of our debts will go away." It's not how it works, but the reason why I'm asking is because I don't see us coming to a solution anytime soon. And I'm slightly hopeful that I'll at least be able to see it in my lifetime. And given that I'm already a quarter of a century year old, I'm slightly still holding out hope in all of my air of sardonicism that someone out there has the gumption to make that change. I'd like to believe that I can make a change to a degree. I like to believe that on the platform that we're given, we can have our conversations and hopefully it can reach others who either agree or disagree and who maybe want to join in on the dialogue. I welcome that. I don't know, but I am hopeful that I'll at least see it in my lifetime.
Hope is the, and obviously I don't try and lean on hope from the standpoint of hope and change. I lean on hope more, certainly more so than the standpoint of authority, just because I hear what you say, but I don't think holding out for a hero, as the song would go,
No,
it's.
I'm certainly not. I'm certainly not waking up every day thinking that today is going to be instrumentally better because there's someone out there who's going to make the change. I mean, at this point, I'll accept.
John Connor woke up and finally said, I'm going to destroy ChatGPT.
I mean, at this point, I'll accept really anyone's stretch of the imagination if the groundwork is laid out about how this can bring equitability in some manner of a system that is better than what we have now.
In the climate that we're in, yeah, we are shoved down our throats the idea that, you know, to have, you know, sort of unrelenting hope or to believe in anything resembling hope, especially when it comes across as saying hope, a la Barack Obama, it's, you know, we're still allowed to have that feeling. And I'm always comforted when there are people that I, you know, happen to either agree with, or I look to them thinking they're quite possibly the best people to listen to talk about the age that we live in. And I say that because there's some of these people that are dying, you know, like Barbara Ehrenreich or Mike Davis. Like both of them, honestly, both of them are, I would argue, two of the best examples of people that, despite the fact that you read their bodies of work and it is nothing but unrelenting doom and gloom for the future, like, you know, the fact that Ehrenreich's books literally keep going from, like, the worst years of our lives, this land is their land, you know, how positive thinking is ruining America, like, all these things that just increasingly appear like they're getting worse and worse and worse. And right. With Mike Davis, same difference. Like, both of them still believed until the end, even though they arguably lived to see some of the darkest days that at least this century has to offer. They still had unrelenting hope that things will get better one day. It may not be in their children's lifetimes. Hopefully it is. But they still look to a lot of young people working today. And it's not even just young people, but a lot of people working today to improve the world around them. And, you know, I'm not talking about all the staffers and whoever that work on Capitol Hill that we know from CSUN. I mean, like, the very outspoken, you know, the kinds of people that the two of them thought, okay, you're actually making an effort based on the standards of what we're up against, based or lack thereof. And, you know, I find hope in that. I mean, yeah, there's going to be perils along the way. There always is. But that's why none of this has a perfect ending, or at least at the very least, that's why a perfect ending hasn't happened yet, is because that's just not the way the world works or how human nature works. There is no Return of the Jedi ending for it all. And that's horrible. I mean, let's face it. Think about the American Civil War. That was a Return of the Jedi ending up until Lincoln's assassination. So, like, that really was, like, I think about moments in history where there's a real hinge point of what could have happened had such and such transpired. And that is one of those moments of, like, wow, we really changed things. As the Joker would say, you changed things forever. Like, we really did that with the United States at that time. But then it was all taken away because best person to, like, help us was shot. Yeah, I mean, it's, and believe me, that feeling of euphoria that something better was around the corner, I mean, it was felt in 2008.
It's difficult to consistently and constantly hear that we're not living in one of the best times historically that we can ever live in. And that's not our fault. It's not a,
right.
I want to say that it's a product of circumstance, but ultimately I think it's more so a product of happenstance, and the chips fell where they did. It's difficult, however, to hear that from individuals, obviously older, who remember life fondly as the best times of their lives. Maybe it's jealousy, you know, envy. I don't really think that our generation has really had that, you know, where we could kick back and be aloof and not have to have such a fiscal stick up our ass and penny pinch and live in an era where it's the most technologically advanced, yet ironically the biggest detriment to one's own social, mental, financial, and economic health imaginable. All these resources, and we don't have the answers to make ourselves feel better about waking up in the morning, just as our parents could have or our grandparents could have. And granted, maybe it's that they had less to worry about. Maybe it's that their careers were more so streamlined and it was easy to pick, even if you were relatively smart or not, is that there was a place for you. And that's kind of my thing, is that I think we live in a time where, and middle class suffers from this the most, is that job insecurity and imposter syndrome and fitting in is just, it's not like back then, where you could sort of fall into a role and just kind of be given that tenure and ultimately be good at it, because you didn't have to worry about school on the sidelines, you know, while you're at this dead end job or going to an internship that didn't pay you any money for the promise of a better job, which wasn't even guaranteed in the first place. And I sound like I'm projecting, these are not my experiences, but these are the experiences of the 21st century post undergrad college student who has to find his or her way in the world with varying levels of uncertainty that, for the most part, if what college was packaged and sold to us as a, you know, in hindsight from our parents, is anything but security. Because what would have happened if I didn't go to college, or if you didn't go to college? Well, not only would our parents probably disown us because they thought that that was the best decision for us at the time, in this economy, we probably wouldn't make it very far. But here we are. Undergraduate and graduate degrees abound, certifications out the ass. I'm surprised they don't want my firstborn child. And it's still not enough. So what do you have? You have a failing economy. You have people who can't seem to get that job mobility and to climb social classes as effectively as, say, other countries may. And what's worse is you have two 20-somethings with their respective microphones yelling at what's wrong with the world, when it should probably be apparent to the outside as well. And I'm not saying this because I have an ego. I understand that when we're recording, it makes the world seem very small and that we have all the answers. But I'm coming at you. I'm coming at this show, at this episode, saying, what do we do? And then radio silence. We're not getting an answer back. Like, I get life has to be uncertain, but like it can't be uncertain to a fault where the expectation to succeed is still there and you're not even given all the pieces to the puzzle. Like, I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. It shouldn't work that way. People shouldn't have to starve, you know? Like, people, I don't think I'm grandstanding when I say that either. Like, I think people should enjoy the work that they're doing and the hobbies that they pursue and the paychecks that they take home and the families that they produce. But it's like, no, it's not. And maybe it was, but it's, I don't look at the world and think that that's an improvement. Certainly not now.
You raise a sensitive point that definitely ties, well, doesn't really tie in a whole lot with fear of falling, but I know, yeah, I think
this is our recap bit, but yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah. It touches on a sensitive point in that, and this was something that I think I mentioned in a prior episode regarding, and, you know, I'm not bothered mentioning him on this show just because, again, he is a contemporary of Barbara Ehrenreich's. Like, they knew each other. Mike Davis's first book, Prisoners of the American Dream, really contextualized the fact that, actually, let me just double check, like, when it came out, because I know it's a little bit like Fear of Falling in that it's, you know, it, I mean, there's the timeless quality. The difference, though, with this book is that it literally, like, it ends off in the Reagan era, 1986. Okay, so in 1986 this book came out. And if anything, it really contextualized a point that you brought up earlier about how, or I guess the antithesis of it, where, you had mentioned about, other decades where living just seemed that much better and easier. And especially just more of a sense of conform, not I shouldn't say conformity, but a better sense that there's something for you
Right.
at some other
I don't
point.
hate baby boomers for being born. That was something completely out of their control. I despise the era that perpetuated the stereotypes that we have of baby boomers now.
Right.
And I despise the I almost like economic chauvinism. I don't even know if those two words are even correlated, but it's the I define that again, whatever that means, as too much money to know what to do with, and not enough intuition to know how to properly be a decent person while utilizing it, I guess, and to think about who's above and below you and sort of understand what your role is in society. Like, and I don't know if I'm necessarily backpedaling when I say this, but when I say understanding your role in society, I also implore those who are comfortable in their position, who do have a fulfilling and happy life, to look at the world around you and perhaps find a need in your community that perhaps doesn't jive too well with your fellow man, whether that be your neighbor. I'm not entirely promoting, altruism outright, that you have to fork over your own sanity at, for the benefit of another, though it boggles my mind how individuals from this era, 70 odd years ago, didn't think twice but to think about what they could get out of it. And I'm saying that because that's perpetuated on their children, and it's perpetuated on where these individuals live and where they go to school and the certain level of expectations and the
Right.
various miscellaneous social organizations and extracurriculars that they have. Things that innately cost money that, say, a person across the town wouldn't be able to do so based off either geographical locations or, hate to say it, the amount of melanin in one's skin.
Well, because again, that's
Like,
because if you try and be an affront to that, if we're talking 70 years ago, that's, oh, you're for,
well, it
equality with your
makes.
neighbors, or you're against this, then that's when the C word epithet gets thrown at you. And I'm not that C word, but you start getting accused of being things that
Right.
you may not be, but
It makes me want to pose the question of whether or not you believe in the, I don't even want to call it a conservative argument. I more so see it as a conservative rebuttal when individuals get in debates and the conservative states, well, show me in the law where it's, say, where there's inequality or injustice or whatever. Like, they're innately clinging to the Constitution, right? They're not taking any anecdotal precedents into circumstantial equations. And they're basically saying, word of law, on paper, everyone is treated equally and everyone has a fair opportunity. And this, that, and the other thing. How do you feel about that rebuttal when it's brought into the talking points of, like, what we just discussed? You know what I mean? Like, if I were to just say, middle class, minority, on paper, you're equal, dude. Like,
well,
what kind of an argument is that?
it
You know what I
isn't,
mean?
because
Like, it's a tone-deaf argument.
it totally negates something that is typically actually talked about more so nowadays in left-wing circles when it comes to
Really?
any kind of progress, which is, if you expect anything at the federal level, you're kidding yourself. If you want to exact or enact rather any kind of change, left, right, what have you, you've got to start at the local level. That's how you get anything done. You can't expect anything
Would you say that
all-encompassing and
that's
rewarding to the public through the federal level, whether it's through Congress or executive action by the president or by the Supreme Court, as we discovered last summer. So it has to be done down at the municipal level or county or whatever. Like, you cannot rely on Joe Biden's not going to save us. So
final question.
I still haven't even finished my point about prisoners of the American dream, by the way.
No, right. But I'll shut up after this, I promise. I do promise. Do you oftentimes think that at the municipal level, at the, you know, maybe the city council level, you know, of course, you know, when people say start small, it's often in your own community.
Yeah.
Do you oftentimes think that there are areas where individuals coming from a small town, they may look at that as their whole world and ironically would never want to change that? Meaning, if you happen to have any ideas that are different, not going to name names, but let's say you're from a town that is overwhelmingly red. You understand the detriments of the county and state legislations that allow it to be that way. And of course there needs to be change. And of course there needs to be equitability. And you're the one individual who is looking at that and stating, this needs to change. You know, both parties sound good on paper, but right now it's a joke. Do you sometimes think that it would be more hurtful to your case if you're essentially trying to not preach to the choir, because no one's listening to you at that point, but preach to people who won't listen? You know, if you're the only individual out there wanting to incite change and you're met with a bunch of podunk pearl clutchers who don't want to give up their ways and would much rather cling to their guns than cling to a difference of opinion, what then? Is it more difficult?
It begs the question of how is that individual that's trying to appeal to those folks, how are they trying to appeal to those folks? Because
they're not, because innately in their leaning, and I shouldn't have said overwhelmingly red, it could be really any color, and it's the opposing side that's trying to inject that. But
right, but the I got
but you're
you
not
said, but
you're
like,
not appealing to those that you disagree with. I mean, you may try to strike up a conversation with them, but at the bottom line, if they sense that you're of a differing opinion, they're going to be like, well, no, obviously not. And then you're booted out the door.
But then it begs the question, and that's my point, is like, mm-hmm. or at least the point I'm getting at is like, you know, for example, that's where you get the example of somebody like Bernie showing up on Fox News and basically, for the most part, actually getting a resounding round of applause mm-hmm. every time. You know, it really does boil down to the message, and it boils down to how that message comes across. And you know, I know we've talked about it before with how you can have that difference of success, of a, I guess you could call it a success rate, between somebody like Bernie versus AOC, and also the fact that, you know, yeah, they like each other. One has, they've endorsed each other a lot, but there's still different schools of thought when it comes to appealing to the masses. So somebody like Bernie could easily go to a bunch of right-wing, I don't know, former factory workers or yeah. farmers or what have you. And, I mean, for goodness sake, the even the Trumpy neighbor of mine from Santa Clarita,
mm-hmm.
it bewildered me because there were so many times where he forgot Bernie's politics that he liked him. Like he would like, and obviously, like I say this because, you know, this is a guy that I'm all but certain, unfortunately, was going through memory sure. loss. Yeah. So like but having spoken with him for over the span of several years, it was clear to me that even, you know, regardless where he was at in terms of the present moment, he really could flip back and forth between Bernie's a great guy to that reminder of, wait a minute, this is what his politics are.
Right.
Oh, no.
I'm kind of wondering.
Tucker was right, you know.
I'm kind of wondering how to approach people when all they know are snap judgments.
I mean, you had the same thing with FDR. Like, you had all the crazy ass people that were calling him a socialist or a communist. At that point in time, both of those things were synonymous with being Jewish. Hence, you know, Hitler at one point claiming that what his policies against Jews were against socialists. It's like, okay, we know who you're coming after. And, you know, and in America, it was to the point where Roosevelt was called, you know, he was called ridiculous names like Franklin D. Rosenfeld. Like, it was nonsense. But to get back to the point, too, about, I think I even had another point that I've actually since forgotten. But to get back to Prisoners of the American Dream and to the point of, oh, well, you know, there's a better decade behind us. Don't get me wrong. There's times where I think that, too. Like, even though the 1970s were, by every stretch of the imagination, a pretty grueling decade that to this day we're not taught enough about just how grueling that decade was. It really did take a combination of, you know, reading, again, the likes of Mike Davis, Rick Perlstein, to give me any kind of grasp on just how desperate things got, that literally everyone and their freewheeling liberal grandparents, not even grandparents, just everyone, even if they called themselves a liberal or even if they formerly called themselves a communist, looked at Ronald Reagan and thought, yeah, he's better than Goofus in the White House, which I say not knowing, you know, whenever this episode comes out, things could be different with Jimmy Carter. I'm just giving you the historical context. Don't at me, bro. But you know, the point I'm getting at is, like, as much as I would, like, I personally look at the 1970s and think, wow, what a decade, because I do look at the cultural side of things, film, music, I'll go so far as to even say attire. A current companion of mine has what she would call 70s hair. So it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, that's a decade that I do take stock in. However, and let's not forget, like, Hunter S. Thompson was killing it at that time. That was like the pinnacle of his career as a journalist. At the same time, and this is something that carries on over into the 1980s, primarily focused within Davis's first book, is that as much as I want to have those moments where I think to myself, there were better decades prior to the ones that I've lived. Even in the 90s, there's that thought of like, hey, no TikTok, no Twitter, I'm in, baby. There's also that reminder of the 90s where, yeah, you've got the same kind of right-wing fascism that you've got today. The only difference is that it's more discombobulated, and ironically, the cult of personality is not around a right-wing figure. It's among liberals towards the president, Bill Clinton. But the point I'm getting at is less so about that and more so to do with, and this is sort of, this boils down to one of those matters of principle things that you and I have talked about for so long, where, you know, and this is something that I've seen even going as far back as the way Eugene Debs was, and I'm not trying to equate myself with him at all when I say this, but I always look at it like, you know what, if there's any decade where people are under the gun of just about every squeezing, alienating, black pill-inducing, poverty-inducing, we're going to cut you off because of your politics, because of your race, because of your gender, because of your sexual identity. Basically, if there's a level of equity that is not being met, and it's not even just a level of, it's more like there is no universal equity of any kind, and there has never been at any point in American history. Even in the beginning, like, you know, that's why I look at someone like Thomas Paine and think, now that's a true American. Like, don't get me wrong, I love me my John Adams, but or Ben Franklin, but at the same time, they really were the upper echelons of America's, you know, leadership. Thomas Paine wasn't. You know, you have individuals like him. I mentioned Debs already. Like, the way I see it is that when you've got so many people living in abject fear, poverty, unraveled bigotry pushing them down, then to me it's not a better decade, because then I'm thinking it may be better for me, but why on earth can't it be better for everyone else?
Right.
Even today, like, yes.
Or maybe why didn't previous generations think to do that as well, and right. Now we have to pick up that slack or those pieces?
Well, we do. It's just that, you know, it begs the question of how effective were those changes that led to those successful changes back in the day? Yes, the Civil Rights Act passed and it's law. How do you get to the point where you have what happened in the 80s with the crack epidemic, and then with the quote-unquote super predator crime bill era enacted by the likes of Clinton and Biden, and then, you know, what we get today where basically if you're a black person, it's open season if you're in the presence of a police officer. Like,
mm-hmm.
You know, I don't even hate this. It's what I'm about to say. It's no different than the Kendrick Lamar line, you know, ain't no black power if baby getting killed by a coward. And that's a lyric that has always stood out to me, just because, like, yeah, as much as, you know, somebody on Fox News will say, oh, but Martin Luther King, he saved all the black people. Well, no, because how do you explain what happened in the 80s and 90s? How do you explain Rodney King? How do you explain Trayvon Martin? How do you explain George Floyd? How do you explain literally anyone? The rights of women. Like, yeah, you had Roe v. Wade, you had almost 50 years, but it still wasn't that much better for women in the 1980s or the 1970s compared with today. And even today it's rough. So
right.
It's that everlasting struggle for universal freedom for everyone, that's the hope you strive for. You know, that's the fight worth having, because you are thinking to yourself, that best decade that we think is behind us is actually ahead of us. And that's something that gives me hope. Yeah, I certainly sound black-pilled whenever I have a microphone in front of me, but no, I always do have that feeling that there very well could be something around the corner. It's just going to take so much damn work to get there. I mean, a good example of that, I hinted at it earlier with Bernie in 2020, and how people that campaigned for him had that feeling of euphoria of like, oh wow, that moment could actually be coming because of what we're doing. Brazil's gone through that with Lula coming back into the, I was going to say the White House, but with Lula coming back to the presidency there. Obviously, he didn't get everything accomplished while he was president the first go around, and I don't think he will the second go around, but that idea that you've got somebody in office that wants the same kind of thing you're looking for, it's a feeling that, you know, you only get so often. And I say that as somebody that takes a lot to make me cry, but it takes a lot to make me cry, especially when it comes to something, whether it's something that really offends me or something that really moves me. So
right.
That's kind of the way I look at it when Aaron Reich talks about these past decades. And I think to myself, yeah, the 1950s looked great depending on who you were. Economically, though, to your point, like, yeah, there is that idea of, oh, it's better than today. Right, but it depends on who it's better for. And I think, I mean...
No, exactly. That's why I explained the tone deafness of,
yeah.
You know, our parents and our grandparents who didn't think to put in the effort outside of just living for the now.
And I have the same arguments with my parents. They look at the 1980s like, oh right. My God. And it's part of me is like, yeah, guys, it's because that's the decade you both met. Like, I get it. But
Right. But yeah,
it's they're also the kinds of baby boomers that'll be like, yeah, every Republican is bad except Ronald Reagan. And you're
to me, it just makes me feel like that era was just an entire phase of life for some individuals where it was like one long continuous honeymoon phase. Like, things can't stop getting better until you have children, and then you realize that those little bundles of joy grow up to be obnoxious obnoxious individuals who just want to lean to that political party to be rebellious, when really, if you flip that coin on its other side, it's just us trying to understand the world around us. It's not even us trying to undo their mistakes. I mean, that of yeah. course comes with the territory, but like, if we can end this just right here, it's us understanding what works and what doesn't, with trial and error along the way. Of course, we're not perfect. And to that point, I think the previous generation will like to think that, oh, you guys are so entitled. Oh, you think you know everything. Well, considering you don't know how to use a keyboard that you can't feel, I'd like to believe that we're technologically more inclined and definitely more suitable and adaptable to inherit the generation that you thought was so great. So, you know, if we can just take this sick dog off your hands, we'll go ahead and nurse it back to health. No, it doesn't need to go on any more walks, or it doesn't need to be eating crude protein. You know, like, that's like, give it to us. You know, we went to college. We did everything you said. We're adults in your eyes. Okay. I'm not saying that I want to, you know, leave you with an empty nest, but Jesus Christ, you know, it's
so. You bring up another. You reminded me of my other point that I was going to mention that you talked about earlier, which is also related to the text in terms of like, oh, you know, how is it that you had this period of change, and yet it just didn't seem like it actually translated into anything material to the point that it was coming out of the federal government and making our lives better, outside of, you know, the war on poverty, the civil rights movement, Roe v. Wade, etc. Well, arguably what's such a bizarre contrast with today is that the quote-unquote counterculture, you know, progressive radical movement, there really wasn't any that, or well, okay, obviously there was, but no one in government at that time claimed it as its constituency. You know, like, there was no presidential candidate that was like, oh, the hippies or the Black Panthers or the Chicano moratorium, like, those are my people. Those are the people that are going to put me into this chair. You didn't have a single thing like that in the 1960s and 70s. You know, outside of Hunter S. Thompson running for sheriff in Colorado, where he was like, yeah, I'm running on freak power. Outside, where he shaved his head and, you know, he's like wearing a gray wig draped in an American flag, being like, you know, oh yes, all the young people are going to vote for me. It's going to be great. I'm running against a sheriff named Carroll. Vote for me, damn it. You know, you didn't have the equivalent of voting for somebody like Rashida Tlaib, for example, or Cori Bush or AOC. And the irony is that, like, in the age that they are functioning in, yeah, as members of Congress, the kinds of policies that they would support really aren't getting a lot of traction, recognition, or just getting passed at all. It's the perverted contradiction of how politics can work, especially when you can have an opportunist like the likes of Lyndon Johnson, for example, pass civil rights, get legislation across to battle poverty, and yet this is like one of the most corrupt politicians in the history of American politics. You know, he's not a hippie. That's the kind of stuff that that gains any kind of pull that leads to change, but then that change doesn't go on any further because that person winds up getting their yoo-hoo tangled up in something like Vietnam. Whereas today, it's like, no, I'm going up against the immovable object known as Congress, and I got to deal with the likes of Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz, and that's why you can't have health care, because we got to make sure there's more money going towards blowing up another fucking balloon. Yeah, I know this episode's gone long, but you know what? There are episodes of Diet NIMBY that went on way too long.
Right.
It's okay. So, are we going to say bye, Sebastian?
Yeah, bye, Sebastian.
You did the thing! Yep. The thing. I was trying to get you to do that like in episode 2. Take it easy, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Falling Middle Cast. Our co-hosts are Ryan Mancini and Sebastian Shug. Episodes are produced by Ryan Mancini and feature music by Kevin MacLeod. Check out our main series, Mars on Life, or listen to our other spinoff, Diet NIMBY, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.